Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. There has been much conflict of interest, criticism regarding Donald Trump. Using his favorite form of communication, he tweeted that he would divest from his private business dealings as he assumes the presidency. He tweeted, "While I am not mandated to do this under law, I feel it is visually important as president to in no way have a conflict of interest with my various businesses." Ethics experts have pushed for Trump to fully exit the ownership of his businesses using a blind trust or equivalent arrangement. We'll have to see how this pans out since Trump has been known to change positions and wrangle out of promises. As his transition team moves forward, more cabinet picks. For health secretary, his team chose six-term Congressmember Tom Price from Georgia. Trained as an orthopedic surgeon, Price has been pushing for a rollback of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and he has championed efforts to privatize Medicare. Tom Price is an anti-choice advocate the National Right to Life Committee loves. He waged continual attacks in Congress against Planned Parenthood. He has undermined the full range of women's health services. When you go to Planned Parenthood's website and put in a politician's name, you can see how they voted on a range of women's issues. And Tom Price received a zero rating. He's in favor of expanding harmful anti-women's health policies and blocking access to care. Contradicting claims of cleaning out the swamp, for Transportation Secretary, the Trump team chose the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, Elaine Chao, a frequent Fox News commentator. She was Labor Secretary under George W. Bush, and she's been widely criticized for favoring business interests over workers' safety. Bill Samuels of the AFL-CIO said Chao seemed to take the side of employers more than workers whenever there were conflicts. Under Chao at Labor, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration didn't issue a single significant new safety regulation for 4 years. Mine safety inspectors were cut and inspections were reduced. As Transportation Secretary, she's expected to shepherd Trump's plan for infrastructure improvements, a plan which some Democrats said was a way to work together with the Republicans right after the election. However, more recently, there have been questions as to whether infrastructure redevelopment by a Trump administration will mainly benefit business interests. Another person who would help shape infrastructure plans is hedge fund billionaire Steve Mnuchin. He was tapped for Treasury Secretary. The 53-year-old Goldman Sachs executive Mnuchin comes not only from the world of Wall Street, but from Hollywood as well. He bankrolled the films X-Men and Avatar. Like his boss, he has no government experience. Mnuchin would play a central role in shaping Trump's tax policies and lead an agency tasked with implementing international economic sanctions, the Forrest Gump of the financial crisis. That's how Senator Elizabeth Warren characterized Mnuchin. Regarding his two-decade-long tenure at Goldman Sachs, according to Warren, his selection as Treasury Secretary should send shivers down the spine of every American who got hit hard by the financial crisis. She goes on to say it's the latest sign that Donald Trump has no intention of draining the swamp and every intention of running Washington to benefit himself and his rich buddies. Continuing with his picks from the world of Wall Street, the Trump team tapped billionaire investor Wilbur Ross for Commerce Secretary. In a statement, Trump said Wilbur Ross is a champion of American manufacturing and knows how to help companies succeed. The 79-year-old is a donor and longtime associate of Donald Trump. He helped him resurrect his casino company after it went bankrupt in the early 1990s. Ross is known for his investments in distressed industries, failing steel and textile mills in the Midwest and South, and coal mines in Appalachia. According to The Nation magazine, Wilbur Ross was dubbed the King of Bankruptcy. He cut jobs, wages, pensions, and health benefits at the companies he acquired, and he reaped the profits. He helped shape the Trump campaign's views on trade policy, blaming NAFTA, the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement with Canada and Mexico, and the 2001 entry of China into the World Trade Organization for causing massive U.S. factory job losses. Ross's net worth is pegged by Forbes at about $2.9 billion. He heads the private equity firm W.L. Ross & Co. in New York. On his watch, 12 miners died after he acquired a West Virginia mine in 2006. While incoming Senate Minority Leader New York's Chuck Schumer expressed hope that Trump would nominate mainstream candidates, it's looking more like conservative Mike Pence's dream team. One ray of sunshine, however, comes with an announcement this afternoon that Preet Bharara will stay on as federal prosecutor. Bharara was appointed in 2009 by President Obama. Previously, he was chief counsel to Chuck Schumer. Bharara also played a leading role in the Senate Judiciary Committee's investigation into the firings of federal prosecutors under President George W. Bush. He said he met with Trump. They discussed whether or not Bharara would be prepared to stay on as U.S. attorney to do the work as it has always been done, independently without fear or favor for the last 7 years. Bharara said he also met with Jeff Sessions, Trump's pick for attorney general, who also asked him to stay. In other news today, Green Party presidential nominee Jill Stein requested a full hand recount of Michigan's presidential vote. The campaign already requested recounts in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Trump won all three states, but he defeated Democrat Hillary Clinton in Michigan by only 10,704 votes, this out of nearly 4.8 million ballots cast. Stein alleges that irregularities and the potential for hacking into scanning devices call into question the results. The Michigan recount could start as early as Friday. Trump's victory is highly unlikely to be reversed in any of the states, but Stein and her camp say the recount will ensure the integrity of the election. Even though there is widespread frustration among Democrats over the result of the election, House Democrats today went with the status quo. They reelected Nancy Pelosi as minority leader. There were 63 votes for Pelosi's opponent, Ohio's Tim Ryan. That's the largest number of defectors Pelosi has seen since she began leading House Democrats back in 2002. And this is the news on WBAI in New York. In international news, the UN Security Council has imposed tough sanctions on DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. This is over its fifth nuclear test in September. The Council's five veto-wielding powers, the U.S., China, Britain, Russia, and France, agreed to new measures. They target Pyongyang's export earnings. Deanne Penn reports.
The UN Secretary General described the country's nuclear activities as one of the most enduring and pressing peace and security challenges of our time. Mr. Ban noted that the resolution was 3 months in the making, reflecting what he described as the complex nature of this challenge. The resolution calls on governments to suspend scientific and technical cooperation with the DPRK, except in certain cases such as medical exchanges. The country, also known as North Korea, has also been prohibited from supplying, selling, or transferring coal, iron, and iron ore, among other measures. Here's the UN Secretary General speaking in the Security Council chamber.
Today's resolution includes the toughest and most comprehensive sanctions regime ever imposed by the Security Council. It sends an unequivocal message that the DPRK must cease further provocative actions and comply fully with its international obligations. Targeted sanctions matter. The Security Council sanctions represent the clear and unified will of the international community.
Mr. Ban urged countries to ensure that the sanctions are fully implemented. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Around the world, the death of Fidel Castro has elicited strong emotions, with detractors openly celebrating while many throughout the world and within Cuba mourn openly. Memorials are planned for many countries, including a large event in London's Bolivar Hall this on December 5th and Puerto Rico's College of Attorneys on December 2nd. Fidel's ashes have begun a four-day journey across Cuba from Havana to their resting place in the eastern city of Santiago de Cuba. In Havana, before the voyage, his ashes were placed at the Jose Marti Memorial. Margaret Gilpin reports.
Galvanized by a 21-gun salute that thundered across Havana, Tens of thousands of Cubans paid their final respects to their beloved elder statesman. It's there that the public, by the thousands, stood in long lines with an average wait time of 5 hours to enter the memorial and pay their respects to their commander-in-chief. They filed somberly past a photo of Fidel gazing off into the distance with a backpack and a rifle, flanked by an honor guard and surrounded by flowers. The long lines, the seriousness and the sadness of the people in Cuba stand in stark contrast to the coverage in the United States of the partygoers in the streets of Union City, New Jersey, and Miami, Florida. At the end of the 2 days, the final ceremonial honor guard was led by President Raul Castro, accompanied by First Vice President of the Republic, Miguel Diaz-Canel, and other government officials. The closing of the Martí Memorial was followed by a massive rally in Revolution Square last night. Hundreds of thousands of Cubans reportedly attended, chanting Fidel and Long Live the Revolution. The rally was attended by foreign dignitaries who came from Latin America, Africa, Europe, Canada, and many other countries. The United States, however, sent a senior advisor to Obama and the top U.S. diplomat in Havana, quote, without the status of a presidential delegation. South African President Jacob Zuma hailed Fidel as, quote, one of the great heroes of the 20th century, citing his opposition to apartheid and his deployment of Cuban troops to back Angola's government against the rebels in 1975. From Havana, Fidel's ashes will be carried in a funeral cortege to his final resting place in Santiago de Cuba, the city called the birthplace of the revolution. The ashes will be interred on December 3rd. The four-day route being followed is the same route taken by the victorious rebel army when the revolutionary forces defeated the U.S.-backed Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista and marched into Havana in 1959. This is Margaret Gilpin for WBAI News, New York.
Margaret Gilpin is co-host with Sally O'Brien of WBAI's long-running radio program, Cuba in Focus. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. She lived in Cuba for many years and has authored 3 books about Cuba, talking about revolution, the greening of the revolution, and No Free Lunch, Food and Revolution in Cuba. She says on the death of Fidel Castro, it's important for progressives to look at the numerous things his life represented and how the people of Cuba have fared under his leadership.
As the ashes of Fidel Castro are making their way across the island, I wanted to give a commentary on my own views, having lived in Cuba for several years. I understand that the revolution overthrew a repressive dictatorship that had kept a good part of the country in abject poverty, and that the goals of the revolution were beautiful: to redistribute the wealth, to bring people who never had a chance to get educated into a new society where the illiteracy was wiped out, in a campaign that has become emblematic of how a country can, with emphasis on education, in the course of a very short period of time, teach everybody how to read and write, get people enrolled in schools who never had a chance before, bring college education to people who never dreamed of such an aspiration. So the literacy campaign and education have been an incredible hallmark of the revolution. And the other is healthcare. While we in this country are still fighting to get a healthcare system that guarantees us the right to care no matter our income, the Cubans have had that since the time of the revolution, with an emphasis that healthcare is a human right, that nobody should have to pay for healthcare. And the kind of training of doctors and nurses and the setting up of an incredible system of doctors in every neighborhood that would make home visits, that would understand the needs of every person in their community, that would provide free care at any time of day or night, the hospitals where you could get the best treatment. This was all something that was done in a very poor country, and the training of doctors then to be sent overseas. Cuba sent more doctors overseas than any country in the world. And let's remember, it is a tiny island nation with only about 11 million people. So this accomplishment of sending healthcare to rural parts of villages throughout Africa and Latin America, places like Haiti, is an accomplishment that has led to saving the lives of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. But on the negative side, I think the worst policies of the revolution were taking over all of the businesses and turning them into state-run businesses. And that means everything, not only big things like big state-run farms, but all the way down to the restaurants or the local vendor on the corner. And Cubans, who are very entrepreneurial people, suddenly found that they had to work for the government. And that has been a tremendous impediment to the economy for all of these years. The other thing is that because of the blockade, Cubans had to become dependent on first the Soviet Union. And so, of course, when the Soviet Union fell apart, that was devastating to the Cuban economy, which lost in one fell swoop 30-40% of the economic power of the island. And so they went into a tailspin that led to really, for the first time since the revolution, terrible conditions that included even lack of food and malnutrition and lack of transportation and people suffering in terrible ways. The revolution came back from that and then became dependent on another country, on Venezuela, for the cheap oil that Venezuela provided in exchange for the Cubans sending large numbers of doctors and healthcare workers to Venezuela. And now with the crisis in the Venezuelan economy, that too has collapsed. And so Cuba has had to rely on tourism, which is a very, very difficult industry because it has a lot of elements to it that go against the basic values of the revolution as part of the opening up to outsiders. It's the outsiders with money. It brings things like prostitution. It brings new class differences. The opening up of some self-employment, while it's been absolutely necessary, it's also led to greater class and race differences because the white population in Cuba tended to have more relatives overseas, like in the United States, who could send them back money to help them start businesses. The white population tended to have larger homes in Cuba, which are now being used for Airbnb and for hosting tourists. And so that sector of the population has access to dollars, becomes a lot richer than the rest of the population that have been stuck working for state industries that barely function and that pay ridiculous sums like $25 a month. Now, remember, when you hear something like $25, $30, $40 a month, it's hard to compute in the U.S. because the Cubans have had, since the time of the revolution, a ration system that guarantees the basic foods, except in the worst of that special period when the Soviet Union collapsed. Cubans are guaranteed a monthly ration, but it's not enough, and it's a very monotonous diet. So the differences in race and class that had been erased at one time of the revolution have come back again. So I would say that the Cuban population, while they are mourning Fidel Castro in vast numbers, and the older people remain in large part committed to the revolutionary ideals, for the young people, the revolution doesn't have all that much meaning anymore. It just means they're living in a poor country where, yes, they have access to education and healthcare, but they don't have a lot of options for jobs. They don't have easy access to things like the internet. They are living pretty simply and also on an island where a lot of young people have aspirations to travel the world, to see more, to get better jobs, more material goods. And so I think when you look back at Fidel Castro's life, you see that he made Cuba a country that, although it was a poor Caribbean small nation, had a huge impact on the world, stood up to the U.S. imperial governments for administration after administration showed that living right next to the United States and being subjected to this very crippling blockade, that Cuba could survive. And that's something that has been inspiring for people and revolutions throughout the world. Latin America, you see the love that they have in places like Bolivia and Ecuador and Chile and so many other places for Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution. You look at the people in South Africa and Nelson Mandela saying they would have never been liberated from the apartheid regime if it had not been for the help of Fidel Castro in Cuba, the way that the Cubans acted to help overthrow oppressive regimes in other parts of Africa. Cuba's had a tremendous impact on the world. And with all the faults, with all the problems, with the lack of free speech, freedom of assembly, the lack of a dynamic political system where they could change the rulers and not have just the Castro family in power for all these decades, you have to put that and weigh that against the positive things that Fidel's life and the legacy of him in the revolution have had, not only on that tiny nation, but on the entire world. And that has been one of tremendous importance. And I hope that as we follow the ashes of Fidel Castro across the country and read the positive and the negative things about him and his accomplishments, we keep in mind all the people and societies that have been impacted positively by Fidel Castro and the example of the Cuban Revolution.
Medea Benjamin is co-founder of the peace group Code Pink. She lived in Cuba for years and is author of many books on Cuba. Her most recent book is on Saudi Arabia. It's called Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. The $3.8 billion pipeline to carry North Dakota Bakken crude oil to a shipping point in Illinois is nearly complete, except for a stretch beneath a Missouri River reservoir in southern North Dakota. That's where the Sioux Tribe at Standing Rock says the project threatens the drinking water on its nearby reservation, as well as native sacred sites. So far, police have made nearly 575 arrests of water protectors and others protesting the pipeline since August, WBAI's Earth Mom reports.
It's a complete assault on what's decent and right and just about our nation.
Actor-director-activist Mark Ruffalo went to Standing Rock to join resistance over the Dakota Access Pipeline. He and Native Renewables founder Walea Johns of the Navajo Nation delivered two solar trucks to the camp, and Ruffalo was horrified by what he saw.
It's an assault on the very thing that is the only way that Americans can address their grievances in the most profound way, which is peaceful assembly. I'm shocked and I'm outraged by the stories that I've heard of the violence and aggravation and militarization of the police force here. It's absolutely disgusting. They've been blocking social media here, which is unbelievable. I'm overwhelmed by what I've seen and heard.
And the lack of decent, humane treatment continues, as North Dakota Governor Dalrymple gave an emergency evacuation order to the Ocheti Shokoni camp during a snowstorm. And while the governor talks about the safety of the water protectors, he issued a statement saying, "The general public is hereby notified that emergency services probably will not be available under the current winter conditions." But Phyllis Young, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe representative, says Dalrymple doesn't need to worry about Native people on their own land.
The governor of North Dakota has no jurisdiction in treaty territory, and that we feel that no matter what his position is, he is in a conflict of interest. He has interest in the railroad claims that we have that we'd like to get to federal court with. He has oil development and wells in the Bakken, and so we would kindly ask the governor to remove himself as a spokesperson, maybe giving up his seat early.
The tribe has hired a former federal investigator to pursue charges at many different levels. Young says the governor has no jurisdiction over the treaty land, also known as federal land, where the Ocheti Shekone camp is located. She says they are bringing in a medical team with the Red Cross to address any medical concerns.
We are prepared. We have lived for generations in this kind of setting. We have survived. And so no one has to make the human gestures of great concern that you have over the lives of our people. We live there. That is our camp.
Meanwhile, several pipeline water protectors are suing Morton County, the city of Mandan, and North Dakota law enforcement officials in federal court in Bismarck. The National Lawyers Guild Water Protector League Collective filed lawsuits Monday in North Dakota federal court. Authorities said their use of tear gas, rubber bullets, and water spray was necessary to maintain order. But water protectors say their civil rights were violated on November 20th when the authorities did use tear gas, rubber bullets, and sprayed water at protesters in the freezing cold. Hundreds suffered from hypothermia after being sprayed for hours in the freezing cold. Earth Mom, WBAI News, New York.
North Dakota law enforcement announced today that they will not make spot checks on vehicles headed to the camp where activists are protecting the water. In other news, as thousands of low-wage workers stage strikes and protests in cities across the country, a new report shows that the fight for a $15 minimum wage is making a difference. Andrea Sears reports.
Tuesday's job actions in more than 320 cities nationwide mark the fourth anniversary of the first Fight for 15 strike by fast food workers in New York. According to Yannette Lathrop with the National Employment Law Project, their report shows that the movement has had an impact raising wages for millions across the country.
Since the Fight for 15 started, 19 million workers have benefited from this, and the total raise that workers have received is over $61 billion so far.
Still, 43% of U.S. workers are earning less than $15 an hour. Opponents of raising the minimum wage say it will cause job losses and hurt small businesses. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, November 30th, 2016. The news was produced with Deanne Penn, Sally O'Brien, Margaret Gilpin, Earth Mom, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.